Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 388 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be talking about hypocalcemia. I'm pretty sure I have a hypercalcemia podcast. I call it the Clutch Hypercalcemia Podcast. So this one's going to be the Clutch Hypocalcemia Podcast. This is a podcast that should be very high yield, should be very useful for you to learn. And if you're taking step two, secure step three anytime this month, I have a class. I have the testing and strategies class taking place on Friday the 20th of this month. And then I have a 20-hour course taking place on the 21st and on the 28th of this month. If you're interested, just check out the podcast on those things or shoot me an email through the website. I'll give you more information. So let's just jump right into it. So what is hypocalcemia? Hypocalcemia just means low calcium. That's pretty much what it means. Means low calcium, right? And the thing is, on NBM exams, there are certain core things that can clue you into hypocalcemia, right? So some of those clues will be things like a person has a lot of tetany. They have a lot of tetany. They have a lot of hyperreflexia. When you see those things, that should get you thinking about hypocalcemia. In fact, maybe comparing hypo and hypercalcemia in terms of just manifestations will be helpful, right? So the core principle that may help is understanding that calcium is essentially a sodium channel blocker. Calcium can block sodium channels. So whenever you have hypercalcemia, you have a lot of blockade of sodium channels, so your membranes are not as excitable. But whenever you have hypocalcemia, you are not blocking your sodium channels as much. So there is almost like a lowered threshold for membrane depolarization. And when you have more membrane depolarization, that's why you're going to have tetany, you're going to have hyperreflexia. In fact, if you think about it, a person that has hyperkalemia, right, where you want to stabilize the myocardium, typically you give those people calcium. Because by giving calcium, you're essentially decreasing membrane excitability so that you can keep things stable. You keep things from getting too antsy. And remember, hypocalcemia is one of those things that will prolong your QT interval. But hypercalcemia, its close cousin, causes a shortening of the QT interval. You can also get a J wave, actually, with hypercalcemia. Remember, J waves are not just things we see with hypothermia. We can also see them with hypercalcemia. And just as an extra tidbit, remember, hypercalcemia can cause a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. Okay, but let's focus on hypocalcemia, right? So hypocalcemia, the key things you're going to see, right? You're going to see a lot of hyperreflexia. You're going to see a lot of tetany, tetanic muscle contractions. So you can see some of this manifested as the Svostek sign or the Trousseau sign, right? Remember the CH in Svostek for the CH in cheek. So you tap the person's cheek and you'll have like spasm of the facial muscles, again, just because of those tetanic contractions. And then if you put a blood pressure cuff around their arm, they're going to have carpopedal spasm. You keep the blood pressure cuff inflated. You know, where you have inflations above their systolic blood pressure, they'll have carpopedal spasm. That's what's known as Trousseau sign. And I mean, there are many other things you can see as findings in hypocalcemia. You can see people that have hypocalcemia, they can have a lot of petechiae, a lot of purpura. They can have a lot of like bleeding. So you may wonder, why do they have bleeding? Well, the reason they have bleeding is, if you remember, maybe from step one, for the coagulation cascade, we need calcium for the coagulation cascade to work properly. So when you are low on calcium, your coagulation cascade doesn't work as well as it should. So remember, hypocalcemia can be caused by many different things. The most common cause, right? They can give you a question about a person that has had thyroid surgery. And then, you know, not long after that thyroid surgery, you see the person becoming like, having like hyperreflexia, having a lot of tetanic contractions. When you see something like that, right, you think of primary hypoparathyroidism, right? Because what happened in that person? Essentially, the thing that happened is that while doing the thyroid surgery, you also inadvertently destroy the parathyroid gland. If you destroy your parathyroids, you're not going to make PTH. If you don't make PTH, then your calcium is going to be low. Because remember, the responsibility of PTH is to raise your blood calcium levels. So that's one cause of hypoparathyroidism. They can also give you a question about a person that has many different kinds of endocrine disorders, right? If you remember autoimmune polyglandular syndrome, Sometimes they call it autoimmune polyendocrine syndrome, which is associated with an AIRE gene mutation, can absolutely cause hypoparathyroidism, right? Or they can give you a question about a newborn. They tell you this newborn had seizures, and they tell you that, you know, they show you a chest x-ray, and you notice that, wow, you don't see that thymic cell sign. That's cluing you into a person that has DeGeorge syndrome, right? Remember, in DeGeorge syndrome, your third and fourth pharyngeal pouches, they don't form. So you have no thymus. So the cell sign on a newborn chest x-ray is not going to be there. But you're also going to have a hypoparathyroidism because your parathyroid gland does not develop. Remember, it's one of those chromosome 22q11 disorders. And those kids will usually have like cleft lip, cleft palate. They're going to have those kinds of problems. So those are all things you can see that can cause hypoparathyroidism. And again, if you're hypoparathyroid for any reason, you're going to have hypocalcemia, right? Or they can even give you a question about a person that seems to have this persistent hypocalcemia, despite you trying to give them calcium replenishment. When you see stuff like that, you want to think about the person potentially having hypomagnesemia. They can make that in an alcoholic, because remember, alcoholics tend to develop a lot of hypomagnesemia. So remember, when you're hypomagnesemic, you're not going to respond properly to calcium and potassium repletion. So that can be a cause of a hypocalcemia, right? Or they give you a question about a person that's a radiologist and the person has hypocalcemia, probably from vitamin D deficiency, right? Remember, vitamin D deficiency can cause hypocalcemia because the job of vitamin D literally is to make you reabsorb calcium from the gut. So if you have a vitamin D deficiency for any reason, that's going to cause you to have hypocalcemia. So what are the causes of vitamin D deficiency? Well, think about it. If your terminal ileum is messed up for whatever reason, so let's say you have Crohn's disease, well, you're not going to be able to reabsorb those fat-soluble vitamins. So you can have a vitamin D deficiency, and that can cause hypocalcemia. Or you think of a person that has a pancreas that doesn't work. Let's say they have chronic pancreatitis. When you have chronic pancreatitis, you're not going to be releasing lipase. If you're not releasing lipase from the pancreas, then you're not going to be able to reabsorb fat-soluble vitamins. And you can run into some very big trouble with vitamin D deficiency. Or they can give you a question about a person that has cystic fibrosis, right? They have very thick pancreatic secretions. So since their pancreatic secretions are very thick, the lipase pretty much doesn't make its way to the small intestine. So they're going to have a lipase deficiency. They're not going to be able to reabsorb calcium. So they're going to have hypocalcemia. Or if you look at something a little more common, right? If a person has a dietary deficiency of vitamin D, right? So let's say you're just not taking vitamin D from your diet. That can absolutely also cause hypocalcemia because, again, if you're not consuming enough vitamin D, you're going to have problems with reabsorbing calcium. Or they can easily make it a question about a person whose kidneys don't work. Remember, if your kidneys don't work, you're not going to be able to make active vitamin D because, as we know, the kidneys express an enzyme known as 1-alpha-hydroxylase. 1-alpha-hydroxylase converts calcidiol, which comes from the liver, to calcitriol, which is active vitamin D. So if you have all those things, if you have kidney disease, you're going to have a vitamin D deficiency that's going to cause hypocalcemia. Now remember, you can also get hypocalcemia on exams if you have liver disease, right? If your liver is not working, then you're not going to be making calcidiol in the first place. If you're not making calcidiol in the first place, then you don't have any feedstock for 1-alpha-hydroxylase in the kidneys to make active vitamin D. So you're going to have problems reabsorbing vitamin D, and you're going to have hypocalcemia. Another unusual cause of vitamin D deficiency on exams can easily be a person that is taking something that revs up cytochrome P450. So remember, things like griseofulvin, carbamazepine, phenytoin, barbiturates, rifampin, St. John's wort. If you're taking something that revs up the activity of cytochrome P450, then that's going to accelerate the metabolism of vitamin D. If you accelerate the metabolism of vitamin D, it's not going to hang around for long enough for you to increase your blood calcium levels. That can cause a hypocalcemia. And then remember, you can also get hypocalcemia when, for example, you have a lot of cells that are dying, right? So if you have so many cells that are dying, so say for example, you have a person is on chemotherapy for some lymphoma or leukemia or something, so many cells are dying, they're going to be dumping a lot of phosphate into the circulation. All that phosphate they're dumping is going to bind up your calcium. So like tumor lysis syndrome can absolutely cause a hypocalcemia because the high phosphate is just binding up your calcium. So you're going to have hypocalcemia as a result of that. Also, if you think about it, you can get that from rhabdomyolysis, right? So it'll be a person found down or a person that has, you know, like an alcoholic found down. They've been lying down for a long time. Their urine is red because remember, rhabdo causes acute tubular necrosis. So all that phosphate that's being released from your dying muscle cells can chelate your calcium, and you can get hypocalcemia. Now, remember, you can also get hypocalcemia from some of these drugs, right? Especially like the loop diuretics. The loop diuretics, remember, loops, the basically prevent you from reabsorbing calcium in the kidneys. Well, what's the mechanism there? Remember, loops, they block the sodium-potassium 2 chloride transporter that we find in the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. Typically, the thing that happens is that those transporters, the way they work, when they reabsorb sodium, potassium, and chloride, the potassium kind of comes out again of the out of the cell, and those positive charges make you paracellularly reabsorb calcium and magnesium in the kidneys. So if, for example, you're taking a loop diuretic, you pretty much block that pathway. Ultimately, the thing that leads to that paracellular reabsorption of calcium and magnesium in the kidneys doesn't work. So you're going to lose calcium in your urine, and you're going to have hypocalcemia. That's actually pretty high yield to know for exams, right? Loops lose calcium. A way they can pretty much apply that to you on an exam is a person that has a history of nephrolithiasis. It will not be a good idea to put those people on loop diuretics because it's going to predispose them to forming kidney stones from calcium. Because loops, they cause hypercalciuria. They cause you to place more calcium in your urine. And then remember, another cause of hypocalcemia can be like a person that's taking a loop diuretic, right? So that's Bader syndrome. Because again, Bader syndrome is where you have a loss of function mutation in the sodium potassium 2 chloride transporter we find at the level of the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle. That can absolutely positively cause hypocalcemia, right? That can cause hypocalcemia. And also, if you think about it, if a person has resistance to PTH, so let's say they have one of these pseudo hypoparathyroidism syndromes where you have a lot of PTH, but your PTH doesn't work because you're resistant to it. Even if PTH is around, you're not responding to it, that's going to also cause a hypocalcemia on exams, right? That's going to cause hypocalcemia on exams. And also think about if you have pancreatitis, right? If you have pancreatitis, the pancreas is very, very, when you have pancreatitis like that, you're going to be binding up all the, you know, you're going to have a lot of free fatty acids being elaborated. Those things can bind, because they have negative charges, they can bind up all this calcium that you have. And as they bind up all this calcium that you have, you're going to have a hypocalcemia, right? You're going to have hypocalcemia. And then also don't forget, if a person gets a large volume blood transfusion, so they'll give it as a question, person got a large volume blood transfusion, and then they're having tetanic contractions, think about the EDTA that's in the blood. Remember, we put EDTA in blood so that it doesn't clot. If you're a blood bank, it would make you, you would want, ideally, for the blood that you're storing to not clot. So that EDT, if you get a large volume blood transfusion, you could be getting EDT at the same time. That's going to kill the person's calcium, and that can absolutely cause a hypocalcemia, right? And again, remember, your acid-base balance can absolutely cause a hypocalcemia, right? Although you may not see it in the actual calcium levels, you're going to see it more in the ionized calcium levels, right? So the thing is, there are three pools of calcium in the bloodstream. Right, there's calcium that's bound to albumin, that's about 40%, and then there's calcium bound to anions, and then there is free that's like on ion, like it's ionized, it's completely unbound calcium. Those are the three poles. Okay, well, so the thing is, albumin is the big binder, is the big protein that binds up calcium. Now, the thing is, albumin, I kind of think of albumin as working in a dynamic way. Albumin likes to bind calcium, which is a positive charge, but it likes to bind hydrogen ions, which are also a kind of positive charge. So whenever there is a lot of hydrogen ions around, then, and I kind of think of albumin as something that has to make decisions like, there's only a fixed amount of me, so there's only so many calciums I can bind, only so many hydrogen ions I can bind. So whenever you have a metabolic acidosis, where you have a lot of hydrogen ions around, then albumin has to meet hydrogen ion needs. So it's going to bind up a lot of hydrogen ions, and it's not going to bind up as much calcium in the way of calcium ions. So when you have metabolic acidosis, your ionized calcium actually goes up. And that's going to lower your PTH. Remember, your ionized calcium is the one that has the ability to modulate a person's PTH values. And then if a person has metabolic alkalosis, or you have alkalosis for any reason, right? You can have respiratory alkalosis because you're hyperventilating, right? You can have alkalosis because you're taking a diuretic. Whenever you have an alkalosis, Well, that alkalotic blood is going to be binding up a lot of hydrogen ions. So albumin is not going to have as many customers in terms of hydrogen ions. So it's going to be like, okay, since there's not many hydrogen ions around, I'll bind more calcium ions. And you bind more of those calcium ions, and that's going to bring down your ionized calcium. That's going to bring down your ionized calcium. So as you bring down that ionized calcium, that's actually going to raise your PTH, right? That's kind of high yield to know. So remember, it's only ionized calcium changes that will change your PTH. But total calcium changes do not necessarily change your PTH, right? So for example, if a person has low albumin, well, we know that about 40% of our blood calcium pool is bound to albumin. But that part that is bound is physiologically inactive. So when a person has hypoalbuminemia for any reason, let's say your liver doesn't work, you have end-stage liver disease, or you've been peeing out a lot of protein like nephrotic syndrome, or you have Ménétrier's disease where you're dumping a lot of protein, it's like a protein-losing enteropathy. In those circumstances, you're going to have low albumin, right? Remember, you're going to have edema because of your low oncotic pressure. But one thing that is absolutely going to cause is it can cause a decrease in your total calcium. So many times when people have low protein states, you need to correct their calcium. So how do you do that calculation? Basically, you take whatever albumin you measure. So let's say, for example, you measure a person's calcium and you're like, wow, this person's calcium is 7. Wow, it's really low. But then their albumin is like 2. Well, the way you're going to do the calculation, I'll give you the formula first and then I'll work it out with this one. You basically take the albumin and subtract that from 4. So take the albumin, subtract it from 4. Whatever answer you get, you multiply by 0.8. And then you add it to what you just measured. And that will give you the corrected calcium. Okay. So say, for example, if a person's albumin is 2 and their blood calcium that you measure is 7, then their corrected calcium, first, you take the albumin of 2, subtract from 4. That gives you the number 2. Multiply the number 2 by 0.8. 2 times 0.8, I'm pretty sure is 1.6. Right? And then 1.6, you add it to 7, which is the measured calcium that you got, and that's 8.6. So the person actually has normal calcium, right? Now remember, whenever you have low protein states that mess up your calcium balance, that doesn't cause any changes in your PTH. Because again, when you have low protein states, it's bound calcium that's being affected. It's not ionized calcium that's being affected. So since ionized calcium is not being affected, you're not going to have any changes in your PTH. Again, it's when you have changes in your ionized calcium that your PTH is going to be affected. So please just kind of keep that in mind. And then I would say probably the final cause of hypocalcemia I'll talk about, right? You can get hypocalcemic seizures from this. It's going to be a person that has a hyperinsulinemic state for any reason. So say, for example, you're an infant of a diabetic mom. Well, you've been exposed to glucose all your life in mom's womb. So that glucose is going to cause you to have hyperplasia of your pancreatic beta islet cells. But once you're born, that source of high glucose, aka mom, is gone. You don't have that connection again. But that hyperplasia is a genetic process. It's not just going to reverse immediately. So you're going to still be hyperinsulinemic. And that hyperinsulinemia is going to tank your blood calcium, right? And that can cause hypocalcemic seizures. So if you see a child, infant of a diabetic mom, has seizures, and hypoglycemia is not an answer, hypocalcemia will be a good answer to pick in those circumstances. And also just remember, if you have like Beckwith-Witherman syndrome, remember it's an overgrowth disorder. One of the unfortunate things that overgrows are your pancreatic beta cells, right? So you can have hyperinsulinemia as a result of that. That can tank your blood calcium and that can cause a hypocalcemic seizures, right? That can cause hypocalcemic seizures. So these are all things that cause hypocalcemia. Like really, if you understand all these things I've described, And again, all these things make sense if you just think through the mechanisms. And, you know, I try to get deep into the mechanisms for many of these things. I guess maybe another thing that can cause hypocalcemia, you can think of a person that has a neck mass, right? And this person, you know, has a family history, has a history of like pheochromocytomas and stuff. That's going to be MEN2, right? So remember, people that have MEN2s, they can have MEN2A or 2B, autosomal dominant inheritance, red gene mutation. The neck mass is medullary thyroid cancer, right? Remember that medullary thyroid cancer can produce calcitonin. Calcitonin is literally the tumor marker for medullary thyroid cancer. And the thing that can happen is that calcitonin can calcitonin tones down your blood calcium levels. That can absolutely cause a hypocalcemia, right? So again, hypocalcemia, just the causes, they're pretty high yield to know just in general for exams, right? So typically, again, when a person has hypocalcemia, one of the smart first things you can do, most times on exams, you know, if you want to go through a diagnostic process, typically what you do is many times they'll give you clues in the question that show you that, oh, this is the actual cause of the hypocalcemia, and you don't have to go through any diagnostic process. But if they're trying to get you to pick a diagnostic step for hypocalcemia, a good place to start usually is to check the ionized calcium. Check the ionized calcium. And, you know, the ionized calcium will give you a very good idea of if the person has a true hypocalcemia or a factitious hypocalcemia. But if you don't see ionized calcium, one thing you can check is the PTH. The PTH can give you some guide, right? Because again, people can have hypocalcemia because they have low PTH. Like say, for example, if you have primary hypoparathyroidism, or they can have hypocalcemia and have high PTH, like something you can see in a person that has secondary hyperparathyroidism, right? So measuring the PTH levels is going to help you tease those things apart, right? And again, how do we treat hypocalcemia? For the most part, the key thing with hypocalcemia is just give them calcium replenishment. You know, if their calcium is less than 8.5, but is greater than 7.5. So if your calcium is basically between 7.5 and 8.5, the responsible thing to do is just give the person oral calcium supplementation. That's it. But if the person's calcium is less than 7.5, or, so this is a mixed per deciliter, if their calcium is less than 7.5, or they have symptomatic hypocalcemia, right? So they have like the tetanic muscle contractions, they have the prolonged QT interval on an EKG, then those people are going to need IV calcium. And if, for example, they say, oh, in addition to intravenous calcium, what is the next best step? Go ahead and add in magnesium. Again, when you give a person magnesium, it can help with your calcium problems, right? So I will encourage you, if a person has symptomatic hypocalcemia, you can give them IV calcium and IV magnesium. Again, remember the indications. If your calcium is less than 7.5, regardless of if you're symptomatic or not, or if the person has hypocalcemia and they are still symptomatic. Because remember, usually, hypocalcemia is going to be a person that has a blood calcium that is less than 8.5, okay? And you know, most times, if there's an underlying condition that's causing the hypocalcemia, you should also just go ahead and treat that underlying condition. That's usually a smart thing to do. So I think I've pretty much said everything I want to say about hypocalcemia. Again, please just make sure you know this stuff. Calcium problems are very common, very prevalent, very pervasive on the exams. And again, as I do at the end of every podcast, again, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one, step two, CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. I offer review courses, right? I have a 20-hour step two, CK, step three, you know, also obviously applies to complex level two and three. I have a review course for that. And I have an MBME test taking strategies course, very popular. Tons of people have taken the course, done extremely well on the exams. And then I have a 75-hour step two, CK, step three school. I call it the DISC school. It's something that, you know, has limited attendance, and I hold it a few times a year. I don't hold it as regularly as the 20-hour review. And then, you know, I do have these podcasts on all the podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, at least the most recent 150 podcasts. But if you want everything from episode 1 all the way to episode 388, I'll just encourage you to go on the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com, and you'll find all these things. And if you actually subscribe, I believe, with your WordPress account, you don't have to subscribe, but if you do, you'll get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast. And then I have a new website as well. I guess it's not so new anymore. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. In fact, if you go on divineinterventionlifelessons.com, it's a lot of Bible-based teaching, very short podcasts. Most of them are under 15 minutes long. I have about 79, I think, episodes as of now. And again, I just address common problems that are faced by humanity from a Bible, from a biblical perspective. So thank you for listening to the podcasts. Again, the life lesson I just want to give today is just, I will encourage you, be a person that is focused. A lot of people are not focused these days. A lot of people keep chasing what I call thrills. They want something to be exciting and fun and very short and sweet. That's just not the way life works sometimes. There are certain things you have to endure so that you can get to the other side. Because people have this drive-through mentality on life that, you know, let me just get this thing done quick. Let me find this rapid-fire method for making money. Or let me find this rapid-fire method for crushing my USMLE exams that involves just 2 days of work. Those things do not work. Again, if you want something to work, you got to work it out. So I'll just encourage you, be focused and have staying power. Staying power is something that is so uncommon in the world we live in today. People want to keep jumping from one thing to the other. No, you got to have staying power. Any person that is going to be successful long term is a person that has staying power. So thank you for listening to me. Have a wonderful weekend. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you. Bye for now.